Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Morna Flood Considine. I'm a recent graduate of McGill University many years ago, having completed my master's and doctorate in education at the Faculty of Education. I currently teach sometimes at the McGill International Executive Institute, and I'm an alumni governor on the board of McGill's Board of Governors. I'm delighted to have you join us for both Parents Weekend and Homecoming, so we should have a good blend of alumni as well as parents here. And I want to introduce this fascinating topic. I'm sure people are coming highly motivated to learn more about the phenomenon of pain. Let me say right away that if you are someone who suffers from chronic pain, you have my profound sympathy, and I hope that we can discuss things today that may help you and offer you a measure of hope. Pain is something we all experience at one time or another, but chronic pain is one of the biggest and therefore most costly health problems we face today. It afflicts almost 30% of Canadians, with the rate rising to almost half of those aged 55 and older. The total number of chronic pain sufferers worldwide eclipses the incidence of cancer, diabetes, and heart disease combined. No consolation if you are one of those sufferers. You may not know that some of the most significant modern pain research was done at McGill in the 1960s, when psychologist Ronald Melzack and Patrick Wall revolutionized the field by developing the gate control theory of pain. They proposed that pain signals traveled on nerve fibers through a neurological gate that could be opened or closed. Dr. Melzack later developed the McGill Pain Questionnaire, which to this day is used worldwide to evaluate the patient's level of pain. Melzack and Wall's pioneering work built a firm foundation, and today McGill is the home of the Allen Edwards Center for Research on Pain, which is the largest and most prestigious center of its kind in the world. It brings together 150 scientists who study the puzzle of pain from levels that range from a single molecule to epidemiological profiles of entire populations. Today, our speakers, who you have in front of you, will be considering pain from equally varied perspectives. Each will give a 15-minute presentation focusing on their area of expertise. Our panel moderator, Dr. Samuel Benaroya, is Associate Vice Principal of Health Affairs and Associate Dean of Interhospital Affairs in McGill's Faculty of Medicine. He's a trained McGill physician whose clinical specialty is internal medicine. For the speakers, I will have a little reminder. For some of you, 5 minutes before you have to wrap up. For some of you, 1 minute. And for some of you, both. To remind you that we only have, it's a friendly reminder, that we only have 15 minutes each. I'll now hand over to Dr. Benaroya, and he will introduce you to the speakers and moderate the session. I'll come back and see you a little bit later.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for those introductions. And as you can see, this is a very disciplined proceeding that we're having today. So speakers, you have to keep on time. And the reason for that, of course, is that we can have an interchange after the three presentations with all of you. And as the speakers are giving their presentations, I would suggest that you note for yourselves any questions that you may have as we enter into the interactive session afterwards. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you our three speakers who come from a variety of fields and will be giving you discussions about pain from a variety of perspectives as well. Our first speaker this afternoon is Professor Christina Rosmus. She's assistant professor in the Ingram School of Nursing and works actively as a clinician nurse specialist at the Montreal Children's Hospital in pediatric pain management. She's the 2012 winner of the Nursing Excellence in Pain Management Award given by the Canadian Pain Society. She will be talking about pain as it relates to the pediatric field, and in particular, the child's perspective. Christina, if you could just stand up for the audience. Our second speaker will be Dr. Mark Ware. He's Associate Professor in Family Medicine and Anesthesia at McGill. He practices pain medicine at the Montreal General Hospital and the Montreal Neurologic Hospital. He's director of clinical research of the Allen Edwards Pain Management Unit at the McGill University Health Center. He will give an overview of current hot issues in pain research and will talk to us, and we'll find out later, so keep your ears open, about the four M's related to pain and speak about certain issues such as opioids and mortality, the use of medical marijuana, issues related to low back pain, a very common complaint, and the use of complementary and alternative medicine in the management of pain. And our last speaker is Professor Margaret Somerville, professor in both the faculties of law and medicine at McGill University. She's the founding director of the McGill Center for Medicine, Ethics, and Law, plays an active role in the development of applied ethics, in particular in the study of ethical and legal aspects of medicine and science. She will be discussing today ethics, law, and human rights as they relate to pain. So these are our three speakers. They will be speaking in turn, after which we'll have our discussion with you. So our first speaker, Professor Rosmus.
My first challenge. Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to be here and to partake in the celebrations of the McGill Homecoming Weekend. I'm the person that needs a 5-minute and a 1-minute signal, so I'll don't be surprised if I don't be surprised if I skip a few slides as I go around. So I'm going to talk to you about some issues of pediatric pain. It's really an overview of a couple of issues, and I'm hoping to give you a flavor for the experience of pain in children. So what is pain? There are several definitions, but this one is the one that I wanted to use. And it is whatever the experiencing person says it is. In our case, it'll be children. And children can certainly tell us, and we have ways of helping them do this. And even with children that are nonverbal, we have some ways of letting them tell us in with different means that they are in pain. So the experience of acute pain and chronic pain is very different. So just to situate you, acute pain is a pain that has a sudden onset. So for instance, a child starts to complain that the tummy hurts, and the tummy hurts more and more. And it has a limit duration because you bring the child to the emergency room, they diagnose appendicitis, the child has surgery, recovers, and goes back to their normal life, and that's the end of the incident. It has a protective function because it tells us that there's something wrong in the body that needs attention and that could be harmful. And the emotion associated with acute pain is mostly anxiety. What's happening? Why am I feeling this way? Is this going to go away? Those kinds of thoughts. And we have observable signs that can tell us about acute pain. So we have the grimacing, the crying, the facial expressions, the behaviors, moving away from being touched when we're hurting. And also physiologically, we can measure and monitor things like pulse, blood pressure, oxygen saturations, and those kinds of signs. Chronic pain, on the other hand, and children do have chronic pain, about 25% of children, we think, experience some type of chronic pain. And it is often related to a chronic disease, such as, let's say, arthritis or cancer. And it is the kind of pain that either stays and goes up and down or goes away and then comes back again. So it has a periodicity. It doesn't really tell us that there's anything dangerous, although it does affect function and quality of life. And the emotion that's associated mostly with chronic pain is depressive feelings, because it's never good news. So it means you have to go back to the hospital, which no children like to do, or you have to go back on treatment, or it means that you're going to be having a harder time for a while doing the things that you want and like to do. And the chronic pain has this quality that the body habituates and the children habituate. So they will not show you any signs. And physiologically also, the vital signs are all normal. So these are children that come into clinic looking okay. They sit down. And when you ask them what their pain is, they'll tell you it's 8 out of 10. And then they will begin to explain to you how this pain is affecting their daily life. And you get a very good picture of how this is impacting them. Let's skip this. So last year, Dr. Franco Carnevale from the School of Nursing and Annie Katsis, who's another CNS at the Children's, and myself were asked to prepare a module for the International Association for the Study of Pain on the ethics of pediatric pain. So I've pulled out a couple of statements here that will be the basis of the rest of my talk. So all children, including preterm, neonates, and nonverbal children, are entitled to have their pain, acute or chronic, recognized, I think that's the first thing, and managed using safe and effective treatment. And the other one is that children's pain self-reports should be regarded as credible for children as young as 1 or 2 years old, even younger, I would say. I'm going to talk about a few misperceptions about pain. Oops. I was not supposed to move, but I realize I need my water. And over the years, some of them, thankfully, have disappeared. But the field of pediatric pain and its research is quite young. So I would say in the last 20 years, we've learned a lot about it. And prior to that, there was very, very scarce research and data and evidence that we could base our approach on. Children do not have memory of pain. Well, when I practiced in the neurology clinic, I'm bringing you back to 1983, I would do a venipuncture on some of the little babies to get some blood. And parents would often ask, oh, is my child going to remember this awful pain or this terrible moment or whatever? And in those days, the science was at. My response would be, oh, no, don't worry about it, because we know that the central nervous system doesn't fully develop till 2 years of age. Therefore, your child will have no consequences of this moment. However, we've moved along, and there was a study that was done in 96-98 that showed us that that was not the situation. So this is a slide that shows you a variable that we can measure to identify pain. It's a variable we use in research, not so much in clinical work. And so it's cry duration. And if you look at the slide, this is a group of boys that are receiving their first immunization at the age of 2 months old. And these boys are in three different groups. The group with the square are boys that were not circumcised. The group with the triangle are babies that were circumcised and had some sort of approach to controlling their pain. And the one with this open circle are babies who were circumcised with no approaches to control their pain. So as you can see, the babies who were not circumcised had the lowest response to pain, and the babies with the highest response were the babies that were circumcised with no approach. So this was the beginning of some of the studies in humans that showed that pre-exposure to pain actually altered your later pain response in life. And some of the studies that we have now have gone up to school children and looking at their responses to pain. So children who are playing or sleeping are not in pain. It would seem to be logical. However, this may not be the case. Reason for that is children's work, if you want, is playing. This is how they learn. This is how they interrelate. This is how they get pleasure. And so it is also something that they can use as a distraction. And so we should not assume that because they're playing or carrying on with their activities that they're not in pain. And same with sleep. For instance, little babies who are suffering pain for quite a long time, they get exhausted with it, and so they'll fall asleep. But of course, what we find is that it's not a restful sleep, and it's a fretful sleep, and they wake up and go back to sleep, and so it's not a therapeutic sleep. Children cannot tell us about their pain. I'm going to show you in a few minutes how they can do that, but this is something that people believed before. But there's one very good reason why children would not want to tell us about their pain. And probably some of you know this, and some of you may not. But to this date, and over the years, many studies, and if you talk to children who are healthy in the community, and you say, what's the worst thing about going to the doctor or going to the hospital? Needles. How do you feel about needles? So I think we all feel a bit chicken about needles. And actually, I didn't find this illustration in a children's magazine. I found it in the Chatelaine magazine a few years ago. And it was targeting women who were getting hair removal procedures and advertising this anesthetic cream that they could use. So we're all in the same boat. But the children get very, very distressed about this. So as I said before in the other statement, self-report is still the gold standard. So it means we really need to ask the child. Of course, in certain cases, we're going to be asking parents, but we have to remember that the child can tell us, and we have to remember to ask the child. And actually, there's studies that have shown that there's differences between what the child tells about themselves and what the father, the mother, the doctor, or the nurse would say about rating their pain. So it is very important to get their perspective, and we have tools to do that. This is to illustrate a little bit for you. One of the tools that's interesting with children is drawings. And these are school-age children that were asked to draw their migraine headache. So as you notice, the color scheme is blues, browns, and in art therapy, these are colors that are associated with more depressive feelings, which is what I mentioned before about the emotion that's associated with chronic pain. And as you can see here, it's very clear. She's got the hammer nailing into her temple. She's got something squeezing the head. She's got the sharp electric type of shock feeling. And blue people, so probably people who are affected and sad about this. This one gives you the idea of the impact of this. If you can see the disproportion between the head and the hammer, same colors, of course, indicating that kind of sad feeling. And so this is huge for this child. I mean, certainly gives us an idea of how they perceive differently. This is a FACES scale, and this is a tool that we can use to quantify children's pain. There are many, many FACES scales that have been developed over the years, and some of them are very nice and cute. But on the other hand, we have to make sure that we use reliable and valid tools. And so this one is the revised Bieri FACES scale, and when we started using the scale, some of the nurses and the adults would say, well, it's not very nice, you know. Well, the fact is this was developed by children. So 350 children were asked to draw eyes, nose, mouth, and to illustrate on the left, no pain at all, and on the right, worst pain possible. And so they came up with this composite of faces. So children from 4 to 12 years old, not every 4-year-old probably, but we have some ways of determining if the child is ready to use a scale or a different one. And 12 years old, because the adolescents who could use this, but they think that this is a little bit babyish if we present them with faces, so we tend to ask them numbers. This is part of illustrating one of the important points of children who have chronic pain. I had a student, a graduate student a few years back, who did this study, and what she did is she interviewed children who were referred to the chronic pain clinic but had not seen us yet. And so she interviewed them about what their experience had been up to that point. And one of the categories that came out was not being believed. And that was very, very important. So they said things like, the worst thing is that they don't see my pain, so they don't think I'm in pain, or they think I'm faking pain, or I'm smiling and therefore I'm okay. And certainly we see that in clinic too. And so some of the children are quite distressed and will actually cry out of that feeling of having been dismissed with their pain. So a few things. I'm just going to leave it at that in terms of the experience of children. And I thought maybe that I'd give you a couple of little things that are helpful. So these are things families will say, well, how can I help my child in pain? And there's certain things that everybody can do with no preparation and very quickly that help a lot. One of the things about children is that non-pharmacological approaches work very well with them. Doesn't mean to say we don't use pharmacological approaches. We do. But combined with non-pharmacological approaches, it really makes a difference in their perception of pain. So if you have a child who's hurting or that you have to help through a procedure, one of the things you can do is do positive self-talk. And that's kind of giving control by saying, okay, this is going to last 10 seconds, you're going to count to 5, I will count to 10, and then that will be done. Blowing bubbles. I love bubbles. I think they're very useful. They distract. And also, you don't have to teach the child to relax and slow breathe. Then they do it automatically by trying to blow the bubbles. So actually, sometimes I think that we should use them for adults as well. But another thing you can do is grab a book. Grab the book that the child likes and tell the story and get the child active in the story. So where's the dog and what's happening here and what do you think Sally is going to do next? And so get them to interact with you on a story or telling a story that they know and that they can tell parts of it. Counting and timing I demonstrated. And actually, this doesn't belong in that slide. It was an error because self-hypnosis works very well with children. But it's something that they need to learn and practice, so it's certainly not something that you can do like this at the spur of the moment. Is it important to have parents there? Very important. Parental presence is really one of the factors that really helps the children. During the hospitalization, it has a really positive effect. And that's why sometimes a nurse will say, well, you know, he was doing really well until mom had to leave for a couple hours, and now he's fretting, and he's saying it's hurting, and he won't cooperate, and he won't eat his lunch. Totally, totally true, and totally, totally real. Because they've lost the presence of the mom, who brings comfort, helps them cope, distracts them, and also, you know, demonstrates caring and affection. So it is totally... totally real that the fact that the mother left has, quote unquote, increased the child's pain. If you're dealing with procedures, what they found is that there's a positive effect if the parent stays and helps with the procedure, but mostly if you have a role and you're doing something, so you're using a strategy to help the child. And what they found is that it had a negative effect on the child if you used reassurance alone. So saying, don't worry, you'll be fine, it's not going to be that bad, that actually sort of alerts the child that there's something wrong. And so actually, the last word will be to the child, and it is in relation to reassurance. And so it does cause more distress. And what this quotation from the book says, if an adult tells you not to worry, and you weren't worried before, you better hurry up and start, because you're already running late. So I'll leave it at that and leave other things for the question period. Thank you. Oops.
next speaker will be Professor Mark Ware.
This is challenging. There we go. Okay. I'm a Mac user, and there we go. We're good. So thank you very much. And I'm going to switch gears a little bit now and bring you into the adult world, which is where I practice. And of course, children grow up to be adults. Children with pain grow up to be adults with pain. We've actually got some really intriguing stuff happening now with the children who leave the Montreal Children's Hospital, who've graduated through what is a very caring and a very supportive environment. When they reach the age of 18, of course, the children's is no longer the place for them, and they enter the adult world. And it can be a very sharp transition for the children who leave a very caring, very interdisciplinary support program when they've been managing their pain, and suddenly they enter the world of waiting lists and long intervals between visits and so on. So we have some really intriguing work in that really critical transition between the child to the adult with pain. But what I'm going to talk about here is the focus that we take on how adults approach pain. And I'm going to take you through some of the key pieces. And I thought what I would do is, in the spirit of being a McGill alumni weekend, is use the four M's to talk about what really McGill is leading. And you heard from Mona about what the real leading role that McGill is playing in pain research internationally. And I'm going to talk about pain models, how we actually study pain and how we model it and how enabling us to study pain better. Talk about some of the mechanisms of pain. How do we understand the way pain is actually being transmitted? What you feel, what you experience, and how you react to pain is a field that's been studied extremely extensively here at McGill and elsewhere. Then, of course, the medicine of pain, how we treat it, what we use to treat pain, and how that affects the pain itself, and how that affects the people around the person living with pain. And then management, sort of stepping away from the pharmacology and talking more about the strategies that we use to support people with pain. So there's intriguing work going on in all four of these areas. Just to keep the theme, Milan was where the World Congress on Pain Research, this is an international society for the study of pain, and you'll hear more about this from Professor Somerville as well, as it's taken a real lead in trying to raise people's awareness globally about how much of a problem pain is. And again, you heard that from the opening remarks, that we're beginning to recognize pain as an increasingly important disease globally, especially in Western societies, but increasingly in developing and underdeveloped countries as well. So this is not just a local, regional phenomenon. This is something that affects us, affects the entire planet. And the work that's happening here is really informing and improving the way we approach pain around the world. So to start with pain models, our little furry friends are probably the leading source of our understanding of pain. The difference, with, of course, between animals and humans is they can't tell us when they're in pain. And as you heard from Mona, some of the pioneering work in trying to understand how humans express their pain was done through Professor Melzack's work. But a lot of the work that's gone on to understand the mechanisms of pain has been done through animals that are given specific lesions. You can inject a sort of a toxic drug into the paw of the animal, and it makes it sort of pull its paw back. You can injure nerves in the animal. You can create all sorts of situations where the animal presents a behavior that looks like pain. And you can see this little guy's holding his paw up in the air. He's protecting it. He's not letting it sit on the ground because it hurts to touch. It hurts to walk on it. So, you know, I see people here with canes and that are limping. I mean, these are all protective mechanisms. You don't have to say you're in pain for us to see that you are in pain. So these animal models have been very, very critical. And some of the earliest work was done by Professor Gary Bennett, who's now a professor here at McGill, in developing these animal models, which allowed us a chance to see whether whether we could develop new medications to treat pain, but also to understand what was happening in both the nerves, in the spinal cord, and in the brains of animals who are experiencing these pain-like behaviors, and that has helped us to develop new approaches, which you'll hear about in a few minutes. So some of the things we've learned, it's not just about pharmacology, but it's about the sensitivity. We know that female animals and female humans respond differently to pain. There's a higher sensitivity to pain among women. The environment plays an enormous role, and some of the work by Jeff Mogill and his colleagues here looking at the role of environment, he's done some fantastic work where he found that animals were reacting differently to different stimuli, and he couldn't understand why until he realized that the lower pain responses were coming when they were female technicians in the room with the animals. And he started using male techs to come in and do the procedures, and the animals reported higher pain. When they were females, they found that the pain responses were dampened. The animals were behaving less painfully. And then he started putting in the clothing of the women, his technicians, and the animals behaved similarly. And finally, he would actually bring in the pillowcase of the person, the technician who was coming in the room, and female pillowcases caused the animals to behave differently. And he's hypothesizing this is pheromones. This is something that's in the female, that gives the air of the female technician. The animals can actually sense that, and they'll change their behavior to pain. So the environment is incredibly important. We're just beginning to realize how that affects us, and I'm sure many of us have experiences like this. Diet, Yoram Shear, who runs the pain clinic at the Montreal General, is working a lot on seeing whether dietary approaches, omega-3 fatty acids, soy supplementation, can affect pain. And some of this work came out of the animal studies to begin with. The role of genetics, whether we can inherit genes that give us a predisposition to developing pain-like stimuli. Not everybody who has a surgery will go on to have chronic pain afterwards. We know it happens probably more than most people realize. But we don't know why it is that some people develop these chronic pain syndromes and others don't. We think there's probably a contribution of genetics to that. And, of course, the effects of different therapies on the animal models. There aren't just animal models. There are human models of pain. And we've taken a large leading step in understanding how this can be done by developing techniques that you can administer safely to humans, a pain-like stimulus, that you can then test their response. And one of the classic ones, if any of you have ever reached your hand into a bucket of iced water to get a beer out of the bottom of the ice bucket, know how painful that is. Or if you've ever jumped in a lake in the middle of winter, it's an extremely painful stimulus. And in fact, this cold water pressor test is a very powerful way of putting people's arm in this cold water and measuring their pain responses, not just the way they report it, but their stress levels, their heart rates, and so on. So we can actually measure physiologically pain reactions. Measuring sensations, putting hot chili pepper extract, capsaicin, on the skin causes a burning pain, which is different from the ice-cold water pain, and we can measure those changes as well. And these models have given rise to different techniques of measuring pain responses in people, not just the intensity of the pain, how much pain are you in at the moment, but how unpleasant is the pain. Some pains are more unpleasant than others, and unpleasantness is now becoming another rating that we're using to measure the different qualities of pain that people have. And this is a study to show that in human pain models, and this is coming from Petra Schweinhart and Kathy Bushnell, who are both McGill. Kathy's unfortunately just left us to go to NIH. She got an offer she couldn't refuse. But she and Petra have done some pioneering work looking in humans who have chronic pain and imaging their brains and showing that, in fact, people who live with pain, that have had pain for many years, actually have structural changes in areas of the brain that look different if they've not been in pain. So comparing them to people who haven't had pain, there are actually changes in the brain. Sizes of areas of brain actually get bigger when you've had pain for many years. So this is the first time for us to suggest that chronic pain actually causes permanent changes in the brain. The work of Laura Stone, who's also been doing some of this work, has shown that some of these changes can be reversed if you adequately treat the pain and bring it back down again. So there's plasticity in the brain. The brain can actually change in response to pain and then revert back to normal if you treat the pain properly. So some more really intriguing work in understanding the pain mechanisms. One of the key findings that's coming out of our understanding then from these pain models in animals and humans is how pain is actually modified in our bodies.
We often think of pain as a one-way street. You get an injury, the pain goes up into the brain, and for a long time that was the classical pain model. What we recognize now is that actually from these imaging studies and from studies in the spinal cord, we recognize that there are parts of the brain which actually send messages down the brain stem into the spinal cord that can control the pain coming in. And this has actually given rise to a really, really solid rationale for the gate control theory, which you heard about, that Prof. Melzack hypothesized about 40 years ago. That there is actually a very strong neurophysiological mechanism by which we can suppress pain coming in. And you see this happening all the time in athletes who get injured. They get back up again, they keep playing, and they're able to keep functioning even though they're in a great deal of pain. They're just squeezing this top-down descending inhibitory system and controlling the pain coming in until they complete the task that they have to do. And then, of course, they get back to their dressing room and they receive some pain medicine. So this central processing of pain and these plastic changes are really quite novel and are giving rise to new approaches to treating the pain. What's important to realize also is that these aren't just physiological reactions. These actually affect our emotions. And the way we emotionally respond to pain can also affect the way in which we are expressing pain. And some work from Mick Sullivan's group here at McGill as well is showing that people respond differently to pain if they feel that they've been slighted, if they feel that somebody's at fault. Either the insurance company that's threatening to take their money away, or the driver who hit them at the car accident. If they feel somehow that they're badly treated, or that somebody else is responsible for them having this pain, they have a very much harder time dealing with that pain and managing it than people who recognize that the pain was caused by no other fault than their own or some other random injury. If they feel somebody else is responsible, that's a huge contributor to pain responses. So these are powerful effects, and again, understanding the way that the brain is responsible for these things have helped us to understand how we can harness those, and techniques like self-hypnosis drive these centers and are able to control and suppress some pain impulses. And then pain behavior, how we react to pain, how we behave in response to pain. Anyone who's hit their thumb with a hammer and sworn out loud and realized the emotionality of a pain reaction will recognize just how your behavior reflects the underlying pain. And when you've had pain for a long time, as you heard from Christina, depression, anxiety, even suicidality, and to the point where patients actually even do commit suicide because the pain is so bad, this is an extreme example of how people react to pain and some of the really, really threatening parts of chronic pain. So what are we doing to treat that? Well, you're probably all aware of the classical methods using Tylenol, aspirin, morphine. These are very good analgesics, have been around for a long time, and they're very good at treating the acute pain that Christina was talking about, and probably many of you have had experience with many of these medications. What you may not realize is that we're beginning to recognize now that there are groups of medications that aren't classically thought of as analgesics. Antidepressant medications have very, very powerful analgesic effects, not just because they treat depression, but because they work on that descending inhibitory system. They actually help that system to work better. So there are drugs approved on the market now which are working on these antidepressant pathways, and they're very potent analgesics. Anticonvulsants, drugs which are used to treat abnormal nerve activity in epilepsy, also used to treat pain because there's abnormal nerve activity in pain. The pain messages are continuously being sent. It's almost like you have an epileptic seizure, but instead of a bodily seizure, it's a painful impulse. And of course, combinations of medications, getting the right mix of these pills together can be a huge hugely effective way of controlling somebody's pain. You approach that pain pathway from multiple different levels, you can sometimes get better control of the pain rather than any one single magic bullet alone. And there's some really intriguing work going on in those combinations. And then there's new stuff coming out, the use of Botox, the use of cannabinoids, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. In terms of pharmacology, what's been really striking is that there haven't been any really new pain medications coming out. This work has been done. These are old drugs that are being repurposed and rediscovered as being good at pain medicine, as good pain medicines. What we're recognizing is that there hasn't been a great deal of really new molecules. In spite of all the animal work that's been going on, we're still very short on new chemical compounds that can treat pain. So we're looking back to old drugs, trying to see if there are ways that we can harness pain effects from other therapies. And then, of course, the other thing that people are used to seeing for pain control is the use of injections, nerve blocks. When you go to the dentist and before the dentist takes your tooth out, he or she will block the nerve so you don't feel anything, except a sort of feeling of deadness in your mouth afterwards. Very effective analgesic, blocking with lidocaine. But does this work for back pain? Does this work when you have a pain in your arm that's been present for a long time? It's not clear, and there's a lot of work going on in the hospital at the Montreal General to evaluate the effectiveness of these kinds of things, epidural infusions, nerve root blocks, and so on, to see whether those modalities can offer additional care of pain. And then finally, pain management. And this is where we get away from sort of the pure medications. What's really becoming impressive now in the management of adult chronic pain, and I think the same is true in pediatric pain, is the importance of interdisciplinary pain management. It's not one clinician, one practitioner who's going to make the difference in pain. It's going to be a model of psychologists, physiotherapists, clinicians, nurses, educators, social workers. You really need a team of people to help somebody with chronic pain learn how to manage that pain using all of the tools. And there's some really intriguing work going on globally in setting up these interdisciplinary pain models. And in fact, here in Montreal, we've just opened up a clinic in the West Island with a small team of physiotherapy, psychology, and a physician and a nurse. And that's now being replicated in the Cavendish CSS, CLSC, one in Abitibi, one in Montérégie. So we're starting to move pain clinics out into the community instead of having them concentrated in the tertiary hospitals where, you know, there's a long wait list, it takes a lot of time and energy to get there. We really think pain management belongs out in the primary care, and so there's a lot of work happening here in that regard as well. Of course, educating the patient in terms of why you have pain, what's causing it, how it's affecting you, and educating the provider, the physicians out in the community, helping them learn some of these things about pain management so that they can use their medications and their strategies more effectively. And then access to pain medications. You may hear more about this from Professor Somerville. Access to medications can be a problem, especially in developing countries, and access to support. Access to physiotherapy or psychology services are usually not covered by the public system, so that can be very limiting for many people. And then finally, I'm just going to throw these out there because this is, I think, probably where some of the discussion may go, and then I'm going to leave it. But I'll just throw these up there. These are some of the really hot topics that are affecting us in pain management now. The use of opioids, the OxyContin story. What is the role of opioids in pain management? Are they effective painkillers? Are they dangerous drugs? Is there somewhere in between? This is really an ongoing and hot topic. Medical marijuana, I've put rather ironically there with a registered trademark, because this is really a phrase that wasn't in the literature 20 years ago. Now it seems to be everywhere. There are some really intriguing developments in that regard in terms of understanding how this particular drug and this class of drugs can be used effectively and safely. Low back pain continues to be an enormously important topic. It's still the most common pain problem out there, and it's still one of the most challenging to treat, so it remains a hot topic. Neuropathic pain, when nerves are injured, this is very challenging to treat and something which, again, we're still struggling with getting better pain medications for and better strategies. And finally, the role of alternative therapies, the role of yoga, tai chi, qigong, Chinese medicine, other alternative strategies, is still something that doesn't receive a great deal of interest from a research community, but which patients have come forward many times saying, this really is a powerful thing that I've used, and what should I be doing? So that's really a sort of a blitz whirlwind through the four M's of pain research and an attempt to sort of show you where we're looking in the adult world, at least. And we'll be happy to discuss any of these things during the discussion phase. So thank you.
I will.
Yeah, we kept him up here.
Yeah, I'll watch it.
This clips on.
Yeah, I'm used to these.
Oh, you're
good television. Where we put it up there, though.
It's on your belt.
Yep. These are always tight, tight, tight.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Arrows there.
Okay, so I'm going to talk to you about the human ethics and rights and responsibilities and pain management. Many of us involved in trying to ensure that people get the pain management that they need have had personal experiences of pain And that's true for me. As an 11-year-old, I nearly died from peritonitis. And I can remember wanting to die because the pain was so severe. Now, why I give you that is because that's what we call experiential knowledge. And there's new research coming out that shows that what I call collectively other ways of human knowing, which include examined emotions, moral intuition, human memory, which is another word for history, imagination, can all tell us that it's wrong to leave someone in pain and help us to find solutions to pain. And all of those ways of knowing, are now there's now scientific research that shows they're associated with making good ethical decisions. So contrary to what a lot of people have said, that we use just reason and logic for ethical decisions, that's not at all true. But that's another story. And the story of how I became involved in researching and writing on ethical and legal aspects of pain management is that in 1983, my father, and I'm Australian, as you can probably tell from my accent, and my dad was in Australia, and I was here in Montreal. I'd been at McGill for about 8 years, and I got a call, and the dreaded call said, your father's dying. You've got to come home straight away if you want to see him. So I jumped on a plane and went to Australia. And I found my father in a tertiary care hospital, university teaching hospital, and he was in appalling pain. And I just went berserk. And I finally got a pain specialist to come and see him. And that doctor got his pain under control. And in fact, my dad lived for another 9 months. He had metastatic prostate cancer to his bones, which of course you would know is very, very painful. And before he died, he said to me, you know, it was really great, Margot, what you did for me, that you came home and you sort of, got me the pain relief that I needed. He said, but not everybody's got a daughter who can go ballistic like you do. And he said, so you've got to do something to help other people in pain. And so what I did, I started to write about, I wrote a paper that was published in the University of Toronto Law Journal called Pain and Suffering at Interfaces of Medicine and Law. And what it was about was how could we use ethics and law to improve people's access to pain management. And that work that I published led to an invitation to speak at the predecessor of that Manila conference that you saw from Dr. Ware. It was the International Association for the Study of Pain meeting in Paris in 1993. And I thought, what on earth am I going to talk to these guys about? So I sat down and I thought, all of the things that we might be able to use that were ethical and legal tools that might get a better sort of access to pain management. And I called the speech Death of Pain. And I meant it to have this double entendre, that it was either you could kill the patient with the pain, which is euthanasia, which I strongly disagree with, or you could kill the pain. And so I argued that people have a fundamental human right to reasonable pain management, and that unreasonable failure to provide such access was a breach of their human rights. Now, that was 1993. In September 2010, again this same meeting, it's held every 2 years, and this time it was here in Montreal. And what had happened is, and this is a sort of a coincidence, but it's amazing, that one of the people who heard me speak in Paris was a pain specialist called Dr. Michael Cousins. And he was actually the specialist who came and treated my father when I went berserk in 1983. And he took up this cause with this society, and they developed this Declaration of Montreal, and that is what was actually passed at this meeting that we had here in Montreal. Now, to understand the Declaration, we need to have a little bit of an understanding about the nature of human rights. Human rights try to ensure the rightness or ethics of our interactions with each other at the most basic level of our humanness at the level of its essence, which what you could call that which makes us human. And there's not time today to talk more about that, but that's why I think human rights was such an important concept to use, to get across this idea that this goes to the essence of our humanness, that if we see someone else in pain, and especially if we're a healthcare professional and we say, well, that's your problem, we're not going to do anything about it, that is actually, that goes to whether we've got a fundamental respect for the other person, a respect for them and their rights. Now, two points I'd like to make about human rights is that I don't believe that we create human rights. I believe that they exist independently of being recognized by any human agency. And I think that what we do is articulate those human rights, and that's why they're called declarations. It's also why people can't opt out of them, because we didn't create them there whether we want to respect them or not. So that was one reason why it was very important to call this a human right. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a major example of this. But I believe that this Declaration of Montreal is going to be one of the most important declarations that we've formulated, and I'll explain why in a moment. And I also believe, and this is my second point, that human rights is shorthand for a tripartite concept. That is, it's got three limbs: human rights, human obligations, and human ethics. And sometimes we need to focus on one of those limbs, sometimes on another, and sometimes on all of them. So, for example, when I was in China really hates it when you start talking about human rights. But when I started talking about human ethics, they said, oh, yeah, you know, we really like that. That's what we're into. We're ethical people, and we want to go with that. So that's why here's a diagram that I've worked out to try to show how these three elements interact with each other. I look at them as three separate doors into the same reality of trying to do the right thing by others, and especially those who come to us for help. So, and then you can see there that I've linked it up to how it relates to different areas of law and different areas of ethics. So out of human rights you get ethics, you get law, then you can get all your individual areas. And sometimes you've got to use a whole lot of areas to achieve what you want to achieve. Now, here's what the Declaration of Montreal provides. It says that finding that pain management is inadequate in most of the world, that's an amazing thing, that it is inadequate in most of the world, and recognizing, here we go, the intrinsic dignity of all persons, and that withholding of pain relief treatment is profoundly wrong, leading to unnecessary suffering, which is harmful. We declare that the following human rights must be recognized throughout the world. And that's one of the good things of going through human rights instead of through national law, although you need national law as well. It means that it becomes universally applicable. And here's what it says. Article 1, the right of all people to have access to pain management without discrimination. Article 2, the right of people in pain to acknowledgement of their pain and to be informed about how it can be assessed and managed. So you've heard two excellent presentations of how we go about doing that, but you've got to have people trained who can do that. Do you know that in Quebec, veterinarians get 5 times the amount of hours of teaching about pain management than doctors do? And so that's one of the things that we've been worrying about. How can we, because that's something that all physicians will face and nurses, how do we increase their education? Dr. Benaroya, take note. Their education in pain management. And then third, the right of people in pain to have access to appropriate assessment of treatment by adequately trained healthcare professionals. So the impact of the Declaration of Montreal. Rights engender obligations. If you've got a right, someone else has got an obligation. So a human right to access pain management means healthcare professionals and healthcare institutions have ethical and sometimes legal obligations to offer people such management. And the Declaration of Montreal informally recognizing those obligations, we hope will help to ensure that it will be honoured. The Declaration is not just a piece of paper. It's what we call a verbal act. Just as a judge's decision or passing a law is not just a piece of paper, it makes a difference to the reality that we live in and face. So the declaration, we hope, will change reality. We hope it will change the horrible reality of people being left in pain. The declaration will be an ethics guide and, we hope, an educational tool. Sometimes it will function as evidence to justify giving necessary pain relief treatment when others would assess that. It will help, we hope, to overcome the harmful beliefs of some healthcare professionals who withhold pain management because they fear giving it, their patients will become addicted or that they could get into legal trouble. What we want to put over as the message is that it's wrong not to provide pain relief treatment, not wrong to provide it. We want it to inform institutions and governments that in formulating health policy and law regarding pain management, that they must not hinder their own citizens or others' access to pain management. It's an outrage and a human tragedy that in developing countries, many people in serious pain have no access to opioids, and that can be because of the conditions that our Western countries put on giving foreign aid relief to those countries. They require them to get rid of all opioids. And there's been a shocking example just recently reported by Human Rights Watch that the vast majority of children dying from HIV/AIDS in Kenya receive no pain relief treatment at all. The World Health Organization estimates that 5 billion people live in countries with low or no access to pain relief treatment. So we have to have, I believe we've got to adopt a golden rule, that is, do unto others that as you want done to you, and that the Declaration of Montreal spells out what those others have got a human right to expect when they're in pain. I was also interested in this word, if any of you do yoga, namaste, and I asked my colleague here at McGill, who's an expert in Hinduism, what does it mean? How do you translate it? And he said that it means the light in me recognizes the light in you. And so what I wondered was whether we could say that the pain in me recognizes the pain in you. And indeed, there is some scientific evidence about mirroring of pain, that we can in ways perceive others' pain. Sometimes it makes us frightened of being with that other person. But I then thought, well, that's along the lines of the wounded healer, that the wounded healer can understand what the other person is going through. And so I hope that the Declaration of Montreal will ensure that we all, and especially healthcare professionals, recognise others' pain. And what has recently happened is that Canada had a meeting in Ottawa in April of this year to formulate what's called a Canadian pain strategy, which is meant to implement the Declaration of Montreal in Australia, in Canada. And what I was going to say is that Australia has already done that, and they have declared a national pain strategy. And we're getting reports in from various people about advances. For example, there's a young woman in Alberta who's had very serious pain, and the Alberta Medical Association has just decided to endorse what she thinks the approach should be. And they have also endorsed that they are going to designate pain as a disease, as Dr. Ware mentioned to you. Now, I began with a personal story, and I'd like to end with one. About 15 years ago, I was invited by the Ottawa Medico-Legal Society to address them, and I decided to speak about pain management and euthanasia, and I called the speech Medicine or Murder, which was sort of, you know, caused a bit of a fuss. But anyway, it was an evening event attended by judges, lawyers and physicians, and I noticed that a few people seemed to be dropping off. So I stepped up the rhetoric and suggested that for physicians to intentionally leave a person in serious pain should be regarded as falling within the offence of criminal negligence in the Canadian Criminal Code. I continued that I regarded such conduct as so unethical that I would personally take a criminal prosecution for free against any physician where I found that had happened. Now, I used to teach criminal law, so I know a little bit about it. I'm a member of the Quebec Bar, and Canadian criminal law does allow private citizens to launch a private criminal prosecution, although it's a very rare event. So that was not just an idle threat. It would indeed have been possible. So I went home that night, you know, feeling as though things had gone reasonably well. But when I got to my office the next morning, putting it bluntly, all hell had broken loose. Unknown to me, a woman, a very good journalist called Sharon Kirky, who's a senior journalist for the Ottawa Citizen, had been in the audience. And I think the Ottawa Citizen must have been short of a front page headline the next day, because the front page of the Ottawa Citizen said, "Ethicist recommends jailing doctors." And I had infuriated physicians calling me from across Canada. Infuriated is putting it mildly. They just absolutely blasted me. But, you know, looking back, I'm not sorry that I said what I did. And I think I'd say it again, because leaving people in pain is so horrible that we need to employ every wake-up call that we can to change that situation. And I think that the Declaration of Montreal is an enormous step forward in that wake-up call. Thank you.
At this point, I'm fine. I want to thank the three panelists for their talks. I am sure that they could have gone on in a fascinating fashion for another long period of time and engaged all of you independently. Fortunately or unfortunately, we have all three of you who have given us actually gems from their own perspectives. And it's interesting that we have seen two people committed in their life's work to the management of pain, the study of pain, and then following that, hearing a cri de coeur as to how important both education and outreach and the management of pain is as a societal responsibility. So I think that theme actually links all three speakers, and I wish to thank you for your presentations. And now open the table for discussion. If you have questions, if you would just simply address the panel in general or to specific panel members. Madam?
I'd like to ask the gentleman to contribute.
If you turn on your microphones with the little button, then I think it gets captured by the camera.
Like that?
There
yes.
You go.
The microphone
turns
red.
This won't need you to make a long answer. I'm just going to ask you if... I was intrigued that when you were describing the environmental impact on pain, and that was the animal part of your talk, that you said when it was female environment, the impact went a certain way, and it was male, it went another certain way. Have you derived any insights as to why the female presence caused differences?
The hypothesis that Professor Mogul has putting forward, and he needs to test this, is that it's pheromonal, that there's a secretion that the female body produces that is very subtle. You've probably heard that, but the pheromones mm-hmm. have been around since the 70s, and mm-hmm. you could buy them in Playboy magazine, mm-hmm. you know, as ways to attract women, these pheromonal extracts. So it's been around a long time.
And those pheromonal extracts are calming? What's the effect?
That they reduce the response to pain, so that they actually reduce the animal's behavior. So it looks like the animal's in less pain when it's in the presence of a female.
So it's the hormones that have a calming
impact. Yeah. And he's done some intriguing stuff. He did a study where he put a cutout of Paris Hilton, who's for those of you who don't know, Paris Hilton, the rock famous sort of sex symbol, and he put cutouts of her in the lab and then left the room, and the animals, sure enough, had less pain when Paris Hilton. So there's some intriguing visual and olfactory clues as to how... But it gets back to this idea of the comfort, the empathy, and I think a lot of that work leads to empathy. It's the way in which we approach somebody in pain that can make a huge difference. And while we can't always treat the pain, as Margot knows, sometimes just the approach being listening, giving somebody the ability to talk and explain themselves, that has a hugely powerful therapeutic effect.
Thank you for that question. So we're already getting topics for next year's panel, the effects of the female gender for the good of the world. And with respect to males, well, it's an open question. So the questions, madam?
Yes, I've had the opposite experience, an operation that I had in the hospital, when I asked them specifically not to give me morphine, and the nurse came in after I was in the recovery room, and all she asked me was, are you in pain? And I said, yes, I'm in pain, but it wasn't unmanageable pain. Immediately, I got morphine. Immediately, I started throwing up. And I said, I told you not to give me morphine. But it was a pump, you know, so.
Is that a
comment? Is it automatic? Yes. Is it automatic in the hospital? Do they listen?
Well, yeah.
This is not the only, there was a second incident with someone else, but...
That raises the issue of informed consent and whether you gave your informed consent to that. But if you're in the recovery room, you know, they might have felt that you were not competent to either give or refuse consent.
I was wide awake because I had an epidural before, so I was wide awake.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you were wide awake and you were competent, it shouldn't have been given to you if you refused it. It does sometimes happen.
Yeah, and sadly, the more common story, and I hear you, and I don't think that's common, but more commonly is people not getting pain relief when they ask for it, saying, well, I can't do that because the doctor's not here, or they're left waiting for long periods of time without pain. But pain management is a two-way street. You need to express the pain, you need to express your desire to have it managed carefully, and what you wish to have to treat that pain. And people will tell you, I mean, there are options other than morphine to help manage pain, and you were obviously ready to use some of them. It's a shame, but...
So there's a number of questions. We'll just go in order, sir.
Okay. So this question is sort of addressed to Dr. Somerville, but if the panel wants to comment, they're welcome to. It's two parts. Firstly, I noticed in your presentation that you could, at least to my ears, pretty much replace the word pain management almost perfectly with women's rights or, you know, the right to choose abortion and whatnot. It seems to me, maybe if you want to comment on that. And secondly, do you understand what I'm saying? No, not at all. So basically, from when you were talking about pain management, that it's sort of an inalienable right, it's a human right that people all deserve to have, I sort of thought of the idea of pro-choice and that women have the right to choose in sort of situations like that, and I'm sure you can comment on that. But the second thing is... Just for example, there are places like the Home for the Dying that Mother Teresa set up across the world where they're essentially left to die in abject pain, where it's completely against doctrine, religious doctrine, to provide them with any sort of pain management. And I'm wondering if the Declaration of Montreal does anything that would sort of address, I guess, religious-based pain mediation.
I think you're getting a little bit off topic, but I will comment on that. Some people, for religious reasons, don't want pain management. I heard a presentation, I'm not a specialist on Islam, but in Islam a lot of people who are orthodox practitioners of the religion reject pain management because they believe that it earns them grace in the world to which they believe they're going. And so, of course, you have to respect that if that's what they want. I don't agree with you that there's a human right to abortion, which is what you're raising, and I think that's another topic. Not everything is a human right. And with respect to pain relief and religion, as far as I know, none of the religions counsel against fully adequate pain relief. And what is fully adequate is what is necessary and reasonably accepted by the medical profession as being the right treatment in order to relieve that pain. And we now have a procedure that's used sometimes with dying people that in certain cases you can have what's called palliative sedation. That there are some cases, not very frequent, of neuropathic pain where you really can't relieve it and the only thing you can do for that person is to sedate them to a certain extent. But in all of those cases, as long as you are doing it with the primary intention of relieving the pain or managing the pain, and it is reasonably necessary to do that to manage the pain, that doesn't fall within any prohibition, and it's not euthanasia.
I happen to be a nurse, and I usually have a pretty loud voice. I happen to be a nurse in the States, and one of my peers practices alternative medicine with her patients. In pre-op, post-op, and both pediatric and adult medicine. And both of you touched on that, but could you just expound on alternative medicine and pain, and do you practice it in your experiences?
I'll have a go at starting that. The first thing is to recognize what we mean by alternative medicine, and it's a definition that's changed over the years. Essentially what it means is something that's not conventionally taught or practiced in hospitals. That's changing all the time as people start to bring chiropractors into hospitals. In the States, osteopaths are medical doctors and can apply for residency. So it's a changing target. And what one person means by alternative medicine is not what everybody means. Yes, it's being incorporated. By virtue of being incorporated into some practices and some clinics and hospitals, it stops being alternative anymore or complementary. It's actually part of good medicine. And there's an increasing trend towards something called integrated medicine, which is where you bring the evidence-based practices of acupuncture or chiropractic or osteopathy or other forms of massage therapy and bring them into the clinical setting because there's good evidence that they work, that they're safe, and that they can be added to and used along with conventional therapies. So I think it's changing. Unfortunately, there isn't really a big industry behind those things. The industry is very keen on selling the products and the services, not always keen on doing the clinical trials necessary to provide the evidence. So there's a little bit of a barrier there in getting good evidence forward, but that's changing, and there are some very brave souls trying to do those studies. And I think with that, we're starting to get an increasing acceptance of some of these practices in hospitals, certainly in the adult world. I think in pediatrics, there's been, I'll let Christina comment.
Well, in the chronic pain clinic, sometimes people will tell us that they're doing certain things, and if it's helping, we certainly think that it's a good thing to do. For example, massage therapy is often used, and if they feel benefit from that, we certainly encourage it. Things like acupuncture in pediatrics is difficult to use because it's needles, and you know what I've said about needles. But sometimes acupressure can be used with certain children. And it's a question that we ask in our assessment. Are you using or interested in using any alternative medicines, and what are they, and how are they helping? So we certainly do that. And I think the whole aspect of the non-pharmacological work done with children, I mean, is endorsed by our healthcare delivery. For instance, there's a big role of the the child life workers who work with the children in the hospital around procedures and distraction and all that sort of thing. So I would say it's a big component. I guess with distraction and those things, I would like to also make the comment that, you know, if a child has pain out of 8 out of 10, I don't think that's the first approach. You're definitely going to have to use a pharmacological agent and a combination of non-pharmacological, which increases the sense of comfort. But on the other hand, if the child has a 4 or a 5 out of 10, sometimes the non-pharmacological approach will work on its own.
Okay. Other questions? Could you use your mic, please?
What is the state of the science on using medical marijuana for the control of pain, especially in cancer, with cancer pain or cancer-related pain?
Okay, we'd have another hour, and I can address that one.
I know.
The state of the science, in a nutshell, I think we're really at a cusp here. We're like where we were with morphine 30 years ago. You know, it was an extract of the opium poppy. Everyone knew it had analgesic properties in some way. The key was, how do we finesse this and get it into, you know, a clinically acceptable format? Cannabis is known to have active ingredients which are analgesic. They control muscle spasm. They control nausea. They stimulate appetite. We've known these for thousands of years. We're really now at the point where we're starting to learn, what is it about those components? How can we purify them and extract them? We may still be another 10, 20 years away from getting compounds that really make that effective and safe. In the meantime, people are still using fairly crude approaches, and smoking marijuana is one of them. The challenge is it safe? What are the risks? What are the patients in whom it works? Doing clinical trials of smoked marijuana are incredibly difficult. I think McGill's probably one of the only campuses in the world where it was actually allowed to happen, and I give full credit to McGill for doing that and for allowing me to do the study. I think in the first instance, probably one of the funniest board meetings they must have had. You know, do we let this thing happen? And so it's changing. It's just there's the socio-political components to it. There are medical legal components to it. I think we're really at a cusp. It's a bit of a turning point, I think. We understand the science behind it. Now it's the application of putting it into clinical practice that's really giving us the challenge.
Well, thank you. I live in California, and so the California state government says okay for the medical marijuana clinics, but the federal government and the FBI say no. So it's kind of weird as a citizen.
Yeah, the politics are incredibly complicated. In Canada, of course, we have a federal law that allows it, and I think it comes out of a rights case in Toronto where an epileptic patient was arrested and the marijuana was taken away, and he was having multiple humongous seizures until they gave him his marijuana back, and then the seizures calmed down. And the case went to, I think it was the Ontario Supreme Court, and they said taking away this man's marijuana impairs his health, and that contravenes the basic principles of the law, and it was unconstitutional, and that threw the law out, which is why we have a medical marijuana regulation here. The trick is now, how do we apply that? And, you know, a 21-year-old with mild back pain and difficulty sleeping says, I want marijuana because it works. You know, there may be other strategies.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Okay.
Sir?
My question to Professor Mark. You told that there's a pain, there's a two-way traffic between brain cell and the location where the pain occurs. But when you take some medicines like Tylenol and things, so where it goes to brain, or it goes to the place where the pain occurs?
That's a really good question. It turns out that many pain medications work at many ways along the pathway, so that the drugs themselves usually bind to a specific receptor. And those receptors, as the more we understand where they are, the better we understand where they act. And it turns out that many of these things are actually both in the periphery, where the nerves have their receptors and signals, in the spinal cord, where the first transmission takes place, and in the brain, where the pain is then relayed to emotional centers and behaviors and so on. So the quick answer is all through the system. Very few drugs work exclusively at one particular area. Most of them have many targets. And drugs like Tylenol, we still don't know exactly how they work.
Sir?
So can I follow up that one with a question about the use of a more, I'm going to say aggressive, but maybe that's a strong word, in terms of deep brain stimulation or other forms of actual physical intervention to hit the areas that you're discussing? Is there any animal model work being done around McGill, or other human interventions? Obviously would have to be pilot early trial studies, right?
Yeah, the Montreal Neurological Institute is actually doing a number of, I'm not sure if it's at the clinical trial stage or if it's really experimental pain. Some patients reach the point where they're so desperate for pain relief that they start to enter into experimental methodologies. And there are areas where they're implanting deep brain stimulators into the thalamic nuclei and so on to try to sort of cut that pain signal off really at the deep brain. These are high-risk procedures. You're obviously opening up someone's head and going in there. These are not easy and trivial procedures to do, but they are being looked at. There's a center in Toronto that's studying the effectiveness of these treatments, but they're not common, but they're being looked at.
Yeah, I'd just add to that ethicists think that the big new field for ethics is what's called neuroethics. In fact, to such an extent that Oxford has opened up a centre that will do only neuroethics. And so all of these issues about interventions on the brain and modification of the brain, including genetic modification, and they're all huge questions. And there's a question coming up as to whether indeed humans do have free will. And there's some philosophers who are arguing that we may not, which would mean, of course, that if things like our criminal law or civil responsibility or ethics wouldn't be able to be, certainly not to be able to be imposed in the way that we do at the moment, where we say, well, it's your fault, you did it, you chose it, so you're liable. And they would say, no, you're not.
Hmm. We're getting towards the end. One last question.
So I'm wondering whether there is a fear that human rights concerns are racing ahead of the medical ability to provide for pain relief. If we begin to think that it's an essential human right and it's demanded, we get into the area of risky procedures. And does that concern you particularly, Dr.
Yes, Sullivan? Well, of course, whenever you're talking about something like having a right to something, it has to be, it's not an unlimited right, and it has to be, it's the old saying in law, freedom in fetters. In order to maintain the conditions that you need for freedom, you have to put limits on freedom. And that would be the same here. We're really using that language, I think, to evoke a sort of a fundamental response that says this is wrong to leave people in pain, this is unethical to leave people in pain, recognizing at the same time that we're not going to be able to adequately treat all pain, but to raise that sensitivity. And the first step towards doing something is to raise that sensitivity. And the reason for going through human rights instead of just going, for instance, as I talked about at the end, through criminal law or even a malpractice suit, is because that only applies in your own jurisdiction, and we wanted something that applied globally. There has, however, been a case in the United States where a man died and he had terrible pain and wasn't treated at all, and the family was so distraught about what had happened to him that they took a medical malpractice suit against the healthcare professionals who'd left him in pain, and they got $1 million in punitive damages for the man having been left in pain. So one way that you can look at this is that to intentionally leave somebody in serious pain is actually a form of medical malpractice.
Okay, I think we've reached the end of our question period. I want to thank the audience for your rich questions and the panelists for their very rich presentations. I'm sure there's much food for thought for all of us. Before we end, I just want to ask each of the panelists if they have one message that they would want to give to the audience, what would it be after what we've heard today? You can start in any order. This is a surprise question. I think it's always good to have...
Only one?
Only one.
Ooh, that's a difficult one to do. I guess the children are not little adults, and we have to think about them differently.
Thank you.
I think mine would be that chronic pain is being recognized as a disease in its own right, like high blood pressure, diabetes. We don't always know what causes them. We don't always know what causes pain. But chronic pain, people live with as a disease now. We're beginning to recognize that. And for anyone who knows personally or family who are suffering, recognize that it's a disease and don't be afraid to speak up and talk to your physicians and healthcare professionals about it.
Yeah, and I'd say to recognize the horror of being left in pain and to feel helpless to get anybody to do something about it, to assist you to get rid of it, and that if we can all recognize, if every person you could get to recognize that, I think there'd be a lot more responsiveness to pain.
Thank you very much. Thank you, panelists.
Sam has done a lovely job of acknowledging the contributions of our panelists today, and I would like to just sweeten that a little bit by saying on behalf of the McGill Alumni Association, I want to thank all of you who came here, and I want to thank all of you who had such a stimulating exchange with our extraordinary panelists who have left us a lot to think about. And I want to present a small remembrance of their visit with us today.
To Margaret Somerville, first of all. Mark Ware, Christina, if I can pull a board of hands there.
Thank you to all of you, and thank you for keeping us on track, Sam.
A pleasure to see you again.
Thank you.